This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. It was a scene not experienced in Columbus in decades. The sounds of police using tear gas and non-lethal projectiles to try to get protesters downtown to disperse. Hundreds of people upset by the death of Minneapolis's George Floyd gathered in downtown to call for increased accountability for police and how they treat African Americans.
As a black man, this is something that I know that almost every black man has horror stories of encounters with the police and thus. This is just an opportunity for us to show that we're watching and that we acknowledge the stuff that they're doing to us, whether they will or not.
The protesters damaged scores of businesses, prompted the city to declare a state of emergency, and prompted Mayor Andrew Ginther to impose a curfew.
This curfew is not intended to stifle peaceful protest, rather to protect our city from those who seek to use this moment of great pain and frustration over racial injustice to destroy our city.
We begin our coverage today with our Reporters Roundtable. Joining us is WOSU reporter Nick Evans. Nick, welcome to All Sides.
Hey, how are you?
Also joining us, Ohio Public Radio State House reporter Joe Ingles. Joe, welcome.
Great to be here.
And Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer. Welcome, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, Nick, we'll start with you. You were out there this weekend. Where do we stand Monday morning at 10 o'clock?
I think that we're still absolutely in flux. I don't think that anything has been I don't think that we've arrived at an endpoint by any stretch. You know, throughout the long weekend beginning Thursday night, you know, we saw continued clashes. I mean, Sunday was seemed much more positive because apparently because the police presence was so much lower than it had been in the past few days. We didn't have people out in riot gear, essentially. But I mean, it appears as though we're still at the same spot where, you know, people are likely to be downtown marching today and this evening, and police will be out there likely telling them to head home once we hit that curfew.
Yeah, the curfew does remain in effect. It's from 10 o'clock in the evening until 6 o'clock in the morning, and there's no end date, correct? Mayor Ginther has not put an end date on the curfew.
I don't believe so, no.
Yeah. Nick, what was your main takeaway? You covered the protests pretty much all weekend. What was your main takeaway from what was going on down there?
Well, I think the main takeaway that I had is that sort of what they ended up moving to on Sunday is probably the approach that needs to be pursued moving forward. The officers showing up in that tactical gear, I'm sure this is only meant to, you know, keep those officers safe while they're attempting to do their jobs, but it also, you know, just, you know, heightens the tension of the whole interaction. And so you would see, you know, groups of people approach a line of officers and, you know, there'd be some shouting back and forth, but then it would sort of cool off. And then out of nowhere, there would be a water bottle that would fly. To a certain extent, I mean, you sort of can't blame the officers for being worried because, I mean, well, while the thing is in flight, you don't know what it is that's coming at you. But, you know, the response in basically every instance that I saw when something like that happened seemed to go pretty far beyond what initiated it. You would have, you know, multiple canisters of tear gas, you know, multiple sprays of pepper spray, wooden bullets, and sort of, for lack of a better term, concussion grenades shot above the crowd. Mm-hmm.
Jeremy Pelzer, let's bring you into the conversation. You were down there on Saturday. What was your main takeaway from what you saw?
It was a lot of the same of what Nick is describing. There were a lot of demonstrators with, and then a lot of police kind of squaring off in sort of a standoff. And there would be these moments during which, you know, either the crowd would start yelling and get louder, or the police would just suddenly decide, okay, it's time to take action, and then either start pepper spraying or shooting bullets, that kind of thing. You know, I saw police pepper spray a number of people who were on the sidewalk and weren't doing anything. And I saw police who were restrained and weren't doing anything. Obviously, that is their job. During the demonstration, at least during the day, people were focused either on the police or on demonstrating. The vandalism that we've seen really didn't. You have to differentiate the protesters from the vandals and the looters, because there's many different kinds of people who come to protest. They have different reasons for being there. Some aren't there to protest. You know, there's onlookers and a few who are there to cause mayhem.
Mm-hmm. Joe Ingles also joins us here. She's from Ohio Public Radio, and she lives up in Delaware County. And, Joe, you were covering a protest, a civil rights protest in downtown Delaware, which...
Right.
Which I'm not sure that's happened before. I'm sure it has during the civil rights movement, but it wasn't a small protest either. There were quite a few people out there.
No, they said they had 381, I believe it was, almost 400 people. And it was very, very different. I was downtown in downtown Columbus on Saturday morning, getting the protest down there. I went down again yesterday to kind of check it out. The scene was totally different yesterday, as Jeremy and Nick have pointed out. But in Delaware, the protest was completely different. It was labeled a protest and a vigil. And what they did was, it was silent, basically. People came in, they carried their signs. There wasn't the chanting, there wasn't the yelling. People got down on one knee, and it was meant to be a solemn protest. So all up and down the street, you would see people standing there silently holding signs. Some held candles. As far as police presence, though, you could notice the difference in police presence at the Delaware event. At the Delaware event, there were probably 6-8 police officers that were on bikes. But unlike in Columbus on Saturday, where the bikes were being used as perimeters to keep people away, to keep people out of the street, the Delaware police officers who were on bikes, first of all, a lot of people knew these officers because they're in the community all the time. So mm-hmm. It was kind of like, hey, Bob, how you doing kind of thing. So there was a familiarity with them. They were not dressed in any kind of official riot gear they had on. I believe they were police shirts, the dry fit black police shirt, that kind of thing. But not anything that symbolized a lot of power. It wasn't when we saw the police down in Columbus on Saturday morning, they were dressed up in full gear, and it was a totally different look. So the demeanor of the police at the Delaware event versus the Columbus event was different, but so was the crowd and so was what they were doing.
Yeah, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today here on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the protest over the weekend, police relations with the community, police relations with people of color. It is certainly at a low right now because of what happened to George Floyd and the protests that have happened in Columbus and in many, many other cities around the country. Nick Evans, what's been the city officials' response? I know Shannon Harden, we'll talk to him later in the program. Shannon Harden, president of Columbus City Council, actually was downtown and got hit with pepper spray. And he had some pretty strong words for how this went.
Right. The response has been pretty uniform in saying that, what happened this weekend went too far and was unacceptable. I know that Mayor Ginther referred to it as aggressive in one tweet that has since been deleted. But the overall takeaway, the overall sense among city council members, the city attorney Zach Klein, the mayor, overall seems to be that reform is needed in some form or fashion.
Nick. Here's the sure. Tweet from Andrew Ginther, the mayor. Quote, I'll quote the tweet that he sent out on May 31st, I believe. So that would have been Sunday, maybe early Sunday. "It has been a tough few days for Columbus. I hear you. I feel your pain. Some of what we saw yesterday from Columbus police was aggressive. We are proactively addressing these incidents." And that brought a response from the Fraternal Order of Police, from a statement released by Keith Farrell, president of the Fraternal Order of Police, the police union. said the negative characterization that the mayor painted this department with yesterday was unfair and wrong. And it was soon after that that the tweet was deleted. Any word on why it was deleted, Nick, at this point?
No, we don't know that yet. But what we can say, reading between the lines here, is that, when we selected a new police chief recently, we went through this long process where we interviewed multiple people, had a bunch of different community buy-in stops along the way. But ultimately, it came down to the mayor's call. So, he's intimately involved in what happens with the department. And, their current contract is set to expire at the end of this year. And one of the things that many on council have brought up is the idea of a civilian review board that would sort of step in to look at instances of police use of force. Now, this is something that was recommended in that exhaustive matrix report that came out, I believe, last year. But to actually put that review board in place, it would have to be negotiated into the next contract. So, that is certainly something that is going to be discussed both at the council level and likely at the mayor's office moving forward.
Yeah, Shannon Harden, president of City Council, said he supports that independent civilian review board. Jeremy Pelzer, there are other protests around the state, Cleveland, Cincinnati, trouble as well. How do they compare to what was in Columbus?
Well, Cleveland got a little bit even more violent with people setting police cars on fire, a lot of vandalism, and Cincinnati was about the same as Columbus in terms of vandalism and police kind of herding up, rounding up protesters. But compared to Cleveland and other cities around the country, Columbus, is perhaps isn't even in the top 10 in terms of the damage and the police response and in some cases, the death toll.
Yeah. Nick, Jeremy, whoever, Joe, I'll throw it out to any of you if any of you can answer this. There's a lot of talk on social media, on the web, about outsiders coming in. Have you, any of you, seen any evidence of outsiders coming to downtown Columbus, whether Antifa or white supremacists stirring trouble, folks trucking in bricks? I've seen those reports. Lots of rumors on social media. Have you seen any evidence that this was any kind of level of organization to stir up these protests from outsiders? Nick, how about you?
Yeah, I'll hop in. To be perfectly honest, no, I haven't. There are people flooding in from all over the area, but to suggest that any one of them appear to be from far outside of Columbus or something, or people with malintent, I really haven't seen anything that would lead me to believe that. Primarily what I see is people who are frustrated, tired, and angry.
Jeremy or Joe, any evidence of outsiders, agitators, as been criticized by some leaders?
The Columbus police chief. Sorry, Jeremy.
Go ahead, Joe. Go ahead. Yeah.
Go for it.
Okay. The Columbus police chief was on a call after Governor DeWine made his comments on Saturday, I believe it was. The Columbus police chief was on a call with reporters afterwards, as well as Governor DeWine and some others. And he was asked that question about, do you see evidence of people coming in? And it is something that he's heard those threats. He knows that they're out there. He knows it exists and they're keeping an eye on it, but they haven't been able to verify, that there are actually people coming in to protest. That being said, we've all seen reports of that in some other places across the country. So I don't know that we know that, but I know it's on the radar.
Yeah.
Now, Mike, keep in mind that outside threats are the whole justification for calling in the National Guard to Columbus, for issuing these curfews. That is the reason they gave for the city's response. And in the call that Joe mentioned with reporters, Mayor Ginther and the police chief, Quinlan, mentioned that they had received intelligence about outside agitators coming into Columbus. They mentioned specifically Anonymous, the group Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
But they when I asked like if there was a specific threat, you know, they were pretty vague on the details.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, you can make what you want of that.
Yeah, we're gonna try to track down. There was dozens of folks arrested, and we're gonna try to track down their names and addresses just to find out where they're from and see if there were folks who were outside. But Nick Evans, we're gonna let you go. We appreciate your hard work over the weekend. It's not easy covering these things, managing to try to get the story in, stay safe at the same time. But Nick, we appreciate your help and your work this weekend.
Hey, anytime. You'll have a good one.
All right. Thank you, Nick. Joe Ingles and Jeremy Pelzer will stay with us as we turn our attention to the State House. We'll look at the State House's response to these protests and what Governor DeWine has to say about it. And also, you know, we still have a pandemic to deal with. We'll talk about that when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson filling in for the vacationing Ann Fisher today, getting some well-deserved time off. Well, it got so bad over the weekend, Governor Mike DeWine called in reinforcements to help Columbus police deal with destructive protesters.
I'm activating our National Guard to help drive out hate and violence and to help instill order. This is about the safety of our communities, our neighbors, our families, our friends.
Today, our Reporters Roundtable is looking at the demonstrations, the issues behind them, the response to them, and where we go from here. Still with us is Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com, and Joe Ingles, State House reporter for Ohio Public Radio. Jeremy, you mentioned Governor DeWine's action in the previous segment. How extraordinary is it for the governor to call out the National Guard?
It's always pretty extraordinary. And he called out the State Highway Patrol as well. I mean, this isn't, you know, when you bring in the military to deal with a domestic situation, that's always something of note. And, you know, it's important.
And Joe Ingles, given Ohio's history, we just marked the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of Kent State just last month. The mm-hmm. history of National Guard and protesters always brings probably a higher level of concern here in Ohio than it does in other areas.
Absolutely. And if you looked at social media, the second that Governor DeWine called in the Guard, that was the very second that the social media exploded with people reminiscing about Kent State, and their mind immediately went there. However, I was a child during Kent State, so I have vague recollections of what I saw back then. But I do remember a lot of the depictions back then of, you know, very heavy-handed, the tanks rolling down the streets and all of that. And it was notable that over the weekend, you had to go off the perimeter of Capitol Square by a couple of blocks to see all the tanks in there most of the day. I think that at one point a tank may have gone in there, but they tried to keep that military presence at a distance. So it wasn't right on top where the protesters were, but it was ready to respond quickly.
There weren't actually tanks. They were the armored personnel carrier or whatever.
Yeah, the big guns. Military things. They look like tanks.
They look like tanks. I understand. We understand what you're saying, but I just want to, for anyone who was confused, they're actually going to just start shooting the State House.
About that. I don't know what those are called. So if the listener knows what they're called, please email me and let me know.
I don't know what they are, but they're military vehicles, and that's part of the criticism that police face is why do police need military vehicles? And a lot of the police departments obtained those vehicles when the Iraq War ended and the Pentagon was surplusing them. I think Ohio State has one of those things. And Jeremy, that goes to the whole militarization of police. And was there any talk? It's still early. It's only Monday. These things started on Thursday and was over the weekend that police need to scale back, you know, how they handle protesters, what they wear, what they drive, what they carry.
Long term, no. I think everyone's trying to deal with the current situation. Yeah. I know yesterday it seemed the police seemed to, at times at least until the evening, de-escalate and withdraw. I know at one point there was like one of those armored vehicles, the not tanks were deployed out there, and then they withdrew when the protesters stood their ground. I think in terms of policy, I mean, yeah, like this fits in squarely into years long issues of militarization of police, police relations with minority communities. Like, this is just everything's coming to a head now. And I think that leaders after this need to step up and enact real change. And this is, you know, there's a silver lining to this. It's that this is the time to take things that have been on, frankly, the back burner for a while and deal with them.
Yeah, we'll see if it happens this time. These protests have happened in the past. They've come and gone. And this one seems a little different. It seems very widespread, at least in recent decades, more so than Ferguson was and Rodney King and those kind of things. We'll see what happens going forward. Well, we were getting back to the new normal when all this broke out. And it has been just about 2 weeks since the state lifted most of its stay-at-home orders. Workplaces and stores opened last month. Restaurants, hair salons opened about 10 days ago. So if the reopening is going to cause a spike in COVID cases, most health experts say it'll start to appear about now, 2 weeks after people started gathering together again. So far, the number of new cases and deaths, they continue to grow, but at a very slow pace. The rate of hospitalization still is declining. A lot of people are staying home still. Of course, businesses and workplaces have implemented safety protocols. Joe Ingles, how is the reopening going from state officials' perspective?
Well, it's really hard for them to tell how that's going. These businesses are reopening, but they're reopening on a very limited basis. And so in some capacities, they're at a third of what they could have had before this whole coronavirus thing began. And then it's important to note that with these protests, it has really shut down a lot of businesses that were just trying to reopen. I went down through the Short North area over the weekend, and most of the businesses were boarded up.
Yeah, there was more plywood than glass down there. I went down there yesterday as well, and it was incredible. Some of the plywood was preventative, trying to keep their windows safe. Others were to repair broken windows.
Right, exactly, because there was broken glass from nights before, but then some of them just didn't want their glass open, and they put up the... But the thing, when you looked at it, people were going out there yesterday and putting messages on those boards. Did you see that, Mike?
Yeah. I mean, some of the businesses, I think, put messages up sympathizing with the protesters. And, of course, some other messages we can't say on the radio that were spray painted on there.
There were also some that were inspirational and some that were really, kind of giving out a thought that made you really kind of think about the whole situation that was being addressed there. And, so I thought that was kind of encouraging because in one aspect, because you saw the community, you saw some kind of presence of the community coming together and maybe having some sort of very limited message out there about, hey, this isn't, they were trying to turn something negative into a positive. And when you read those messages, some of them were really uplifting. So, and there were a few businesses that were open down there. I think a lot of them tried to stay open. It's hard to stay open when you have your business boarded up, but, it's going to be a difficult way to go. And then the other thing you have are a lot of people who are just kind of afraid to go out and mix in public still.
Yeah. Jeremy Pelzer, the governor and the health director, say an increase in cases is coming. It's hard to say whether that it will be hard to say whether that's because an increase in testing, because we're doing more testing now, or if it's because an increase in infections. We likely will see an increase in hospitalizations and deaths, they say. What would be an acceptable increase for state officials to handle rather than shut the state down again?
Well, they've been careful not to put an exact number on it, like if you cross, but just in general, they're kind of, subjectively looking to see how much is too much. You know, if you see an increase that just goes beyond what they feel is appropriate, then they'll reimpose measures. And it's this careful balancing act that they're trying to make. And, you know, we'll see if they're able to make it between having risking people getting sick and, you know, risking the economy going to pot. So, you know, they've been careful not to put an exact number on it, but, you know, they've said, like, well, we'll know when it happens.
Yeah. Have they talked about, I mean, shutting down the entire state again, I think would be really difficult for them to do, but you could target an area, a city, a portion of the state that sees a spike. Has there been any talk about contingency plans to close down a neighborhood or a city if they see a sharp spike in that area?
That's exactly where they've been headed. They, you know, immediately they started tackling the nursing homes and the prisons and the congregate care because they're seeing a whole lot coming out of there. And if you look at those areas, they're getting more testing. There's more intervention. And they said, Dr. Acton said, they're going to be looking for hot spots to see where this is increasing, what they can do. And it's very likely that they could say, well, you know, we've got a big, huge outbreak in this area. We're going to treat it a little differently than the rest of the state. As far as a complete and total shutdown, if that were to happen, we would really have some issues because there are still a lot of people and a lot of business owners who want to get back to what they consider normal. We're never going to be back where we were before, but we're going to have to find a new normal. Mm-hmm. And a lot of business owners are pushing for that, and so are a lot of people out there.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people seem to be cautiously venturing out, you know.
Right.
I went by a shopping mall yesterday. I didn't go in, but the parking lot was not full by any means, even though the mall was open. And there were people coming and going with bags. And restaurants are, of course, they've cut back their capacity, probably half to a third of what they were normally. Jeremy, people are still, you know, there's no order to stay home, but people are still staying home.
People are still staying home by and large. If you're one of the people who go out on the street, you know, rush hour isn't really rush hour. I think the weather has something to do with it, too. You know, we went from winter to summer, and now
back to fall this weekend.
2 days of spring. Yeah, right. We're getting the Neapolitan dose of seasons. But I think as you keep going, people are just going to start, Joe said, just carefully venturing out, maybe small groups outside with friends, and then those groups, those gatherings move inside, and it's just getting gradually more comfortable with not being separated from one another.
And we'll have to see how that affects the case numbers that we get each day from 2 o'clock from the Ohio Department of Health. We're up over 35,000 cases, I believe, at this point, and close to 2,200 deaths since this whole thing started. So it's had an impact here in the state of Ohio. Joe Ingles, we expect to hear more news of opening this week, right? Zoos, amusement parks could be next up, correct?
Yeah. Some of the entertainment venues could be next up. And I think a lot of people would like to see that, especially, you know, you think about going to the zoo. Most of that is outdoors anyway. And that's probably one of the safer places to be. Amusement parks, same thing. The problem is you have a lot of people congregating. And I mean, I think that's one of the big issues is this whole spacing thing, because it's kind of against our nature. You know, we're not used to having that spacing. And so when people get together in a crowd, we are not necessarily spacing ourselves. And that's the whole problem, is how do you get that element in there where people will distance themselves enough that they won't pass the virus? And I think state leaders have been trying to get at that. They've done things when they've reopened these businesses to try to do that. But there's no... You know, it's hard to enforce all this stuff, and it's also hard to get people in the mindset of doing it.
Yeah, I know zoos really need the gates to open because, you know, unlike an amusement park, if it's shut down, everyone's laid off and there's really nobody there. You don't have to pay your employees, but the zoos have to pay their employees. They've still got to feed the animals. So mm-hmm. They really, you know, a lot of zoos are in trouble around the country. I'm sure the Columbus Zoo, which is pretty strong, is okay, but I'm sure they're anxious to open up. Now, Zumbezi Bay, the water park, that's a different story. Amusement park, Cedar Point, where everyone's jamming into a roller coaster. Jeremy, that's going to be a little more difficult.
It's going to be way more difficult. You know, and the governor and his administration have come under criticism for people, you know, as they see other sectors of the economy reopening, they're wondering, okay, what are our marching orders?
Yeah, other states are opening up their amusement parks and zoos. And if I'm like the owner of Kings Island or Cedar Point, which actually is the same owner now, I believe, you know, that or the operators of those plants, they see parks in Indiana opening up and other states opening up, and folks are just going to take a road trip to Indiana to go to their roller coaster rides and things like that. So it's a competitive standpoint, too, that the state is facing pressure to do something about.
Right, and every beautiful day like today is just a dagger in these amusement park owners' hearts because this is prime time for them. Mm-hmm.
Daycare centers open today, Joe Ingles, but under pretty strict rules, much lower capacity than some say they can even survive with this lower capacity. But today was the first day that folks, parents, could drop their kids off at daycare, folks who were not working as first responders in the pandemic, anyway.
Exactly. And there aren't as many spots. There are not as many spots, and people are finding it difficult to access that daycare. We've heard that from people who are on unemployment right now and they're being called back and they have children. They're having to face the issue of where do I leave my kids because my daycare isn't open or doesn't have slots available or, you know, whatever they did before the pandemic, it's not available. And so we've got a lot of people making very hard choices between leaving their kids at home unattended, which is dangerous, or, you know, going to, you know, staying home from work and possibly losing their unemployment. I know there's been a bill at the State House that would address that and would allow people in that position to continue to collect unemployment for the full time, the 39 weeks that they could collect it possibly. But, you know, it's still a problem that needs to be addressed. And as you pointed out, a lot of daycares are saying, hey, we cannot open if we have to keep our ratios so small. We cannot afford to open.
We're talking about the current state of Ohio, protests, pandemics. We still have an election to run next November. We'll get to all of that when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Our weekly reporters roundtable on a Monday. Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau is with us. Also, Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Nursing homes continue to be the most likely places for deadly COVID-19 cases. 70% of Ohio's COVID deaths are connected to nursing homes and other long-term care facilities. The very elderly and frail population is most vulnerable to the disease, which can spread quickly among residents who live so closely together. Last week, Governor DeWine announced the National Guard will assist nursing homes meet a new goal of testing every staff member in the state. Jeremy, National Guard being called in to help keep nursing homes safe. Again, an extraordinary measure.
Very extraordinary. The National Guard, the Ohio National Guard this year has had to do tasks that they, I think it's safe to say, never expected, from guarding prisons to I heard a report that they even have been reading to kids, via webcam. You know, so they've been doing a whole lot of different things. Same with the State Highway Patrol. I talked with the patrol last week, and, you know, as the amount of traffic's gone down, that's freed up some of them to, you know, also guard prisons and do humanitarian efforts. And these are things that aren't in the usual job description.
Yeah, and Joe, the rate of death, the proportion of deaths connected to nursing homes and assisted care livings is high. It's high around the country, but in Ohio it's especially high. I think around the country it's 30 to 40% on average, and here it's 70%. Is there any idea why, except for the obvious reasons, but why Ohio is so much has a so much higher percentage of COVID-19 deaths connected to assisted care facilities and skilled nursing facilities?
I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind when we start talking about these numbers is we have to keep in mind that the testing hasn't been there. When we look at these congregate care places, we do see that there's been more testing in those areas than there has in the general population. So when we're trying to compare the numbers, I think we need to look at that. Some other states have had more access to testing than we have here in Ohio and has tested differently. That being said, I think, too, Governor DeWine shut the visitation at the nursing homes down almost immediately. That was one of the first things that happened. But what you cannot account for are the staff members going in and out of that nursing home. They are, bringing in, germs and stuff with them, even, when you take precautions. So that's how a lot of this, can spread, is in prisons and congregate care, nursing homes. That's a very easy way for it to spread out to the general population. But I don't know, when we start talking those numbers and comparisons, I'm not sure that we know exactly what's behind all that and if those numbers are really legitimate.
Jeremy, because that's why they're testing the staff right now rather than residents, because the staff are the folks who are going in and out. Now, there have been extreme cases where a few nursing homes have basically volunteered to lock themselves in there. Staff members, nurses' aides have locked themselves. There was one in Newark, a facility in Newark, where the 65 days, imagine that, 65 days living where you work, not seeing your family personally for more than 2 months. But that facility had, I believe, zero COVID cases.
Right. It's an extreme case, but yeah, if you isolate people like that, that's an effective way to do it, but it goes back to that balancing act. Like, sure, there are no reported cases, but as you said, they can't see anyone on the outside. And so it's really tough, like, because you obviously have to choose between possibly having people die and having people be able to live their life.
Yeah. You have to, hats off to those dedicated employees. There are a few other nursing facilities around the state. All of them, I mean, these folks who are doing this work are just incredible. But then to go to that extra extreme of basically forsaking your life for two months to care for the folks you're caring for and keep them safe is just incredible. Getting to the testing, we are getting a little better as far as the number of tests per day. The goal is 18,000 tests per day, 22,000 tests per day. Governor DeWine says we have the capacity to do that, but we're not there yet. We're maybe 10,000 a day on a good day. Correct?
And the reason is, back about a month ago, he said by late May we'd be up to 22,000 tests a day, and we're not there. And he's saying, well, there's bottlenecks that if you lack, say, swabs or you lack other components needed to test, that whole gums up the whole system, and so we're ramping up testing, but it's a pretty slow on ramp.
And Joe, the governor is relying on the private sector for this, for the most part. He is very careful not to criticize the federal government, namely the Trump administration, for the lack of federal support when it comes to testing. He's relying on companies to produce the swabs, to produce the chemicals, the agents needed to test the swabs.
Yes, he is. And we've seen Ohio State step up with the material that you use to test with. We've seen other companies, private businesses who have stepped up and provided not only testing equipment, but like PPE, all kinds of different things that are needed in this fight. But Governor DeWine is in a very difficult position because, he doesn't want to criticize the president and the federal effort. But at the same time, he is more interested in trying to, he's talking about the aspects, the medical aspects of this and that sort of thing. And he's very interested in trying to implement some of the things that the Ohio Health Department Director, Dr. Amy Acton, has recommended. And he listens to the medical advice and tries to go with that. So he's trying to strike a balance there. And it's been difficult for him, I think, to do that sometimes. But that's a case that he has before him right now.
That's the balance he has been trying, and I would argue successfully balanced since day one of this pandemic. He is just trying to walk that line between public health and the economy and the political pitfalls that can happen if you cross the president or if you go too far to the right, too far to the left. I think he's done a pretty effective job of walking that line since the start of this in mid-March, early to mid-March. There is a bill, Jeremy, at the State House on limiting the liability of businesses. The businesses want to give some protection from lawsuits related to COVID-19. What's going on there?
Well, the House passed it last week, and there's two components to the bill. One is kind of a general civil immunity for businesses overall. Let's say you go into a store and somehow you contract coronavirus from touching a surface, that would grant the store immunity from you filing a lawsuit against them. And then particularly it zooms in, it focuses on healthcare workers and nursing homes and would give them immunity from any COVID cases that arise from their actions. Unless, of course, if it was on purpose or it was gross negligence, it would still allow lawsuits for that. But just in general, it would prohibit lawsuits.
Of course, Joe, the problem is the gray area. If a store doesn't deliberately contaminate an item but doesn't do enough to clean the items or the surfaces, doesn't do enough to keep customers separate, where does that fall? And I think that's what consumer advocates worry about, that people who do get infected from failings from companies or organizations don't have any way to get damages.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big thing. You know, it's like, and with this bill, if it provides protection, are you going to be able to, if a business decides they're not going to have their employees wearing masks and they're not going to enforce the guidelines that are, heavily recommended or even required by the state, is that a grounds for going after them in a lawsuit? And I think that's the question of how this legislation is going to work out, and if it is passed completely, how it would work out in reality is huge.
Joe, any idea how the Senate will act on this? Are they in favor of this? Governor DeWine, does he support this?
Governor DeWine hasn't really spoken to it a whole lot. I think he was asked about it once, and he really didn't give a clear answer. As far as the Senate, the House and the Senate has been they haven't necessarily been on agreement on a lot of legislation, and there are some senators who have expressed concerns about this legislation and where it goes and what we're talking about, how it actually works out.
One of the casualties, this is our Reporters Roundtable here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com is with us. Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio is with us. A few minutes left in this hour. One of the casualties of the pandemic is the political process, namely folks trying to get questions on the ballot. It is extremely difficult to collect petitions when you have to stay home all the time, and people you want to sign are having to stay home, and people aren't voting and lining up to vote, and you can't ask them for their signatures. So supporters of the ballot proposals to change Ohio voting laws, legalize marijuana, and raise the state's minimum wage have to now go back to the streets if they want voters to decide their issues. A federal appeals court last week overturned a lower court judge's ruling, extending the signature deadline and ordering Ohio to allow the groups to collect electronic signatures. Joe Ingles, this is a real setback, maybe even, the death knell for these. They have 1 month now to collect hundreds of thousands of signatures. It's impossible.
Yeah, they need well over 400,000 valid signatures. So that means that you need to collect probably twice that many signatures to actually get it on the ballot, because a lot of the signatures you collect will not be valid. And typically in any year, groups could go to festivals, community festivals and things like that, and they could get a lot of people in one place. But of course, those things have been canceled this year by and large. So it's very difficult. And the groups had been wanting They had been asking the court to allow electronic signatures so that people could go online and sign the signature that way. That's never been done in Ohio before. A lower federal court said, yeah, you can do that, and you can have till the 31st of July to do it. And then last week we saw that appealed, and that there was a stay granted so that that couldn't happen. So these groups are pretty frustrated. There's going to be more court battle about this because, you know, a lot of these groups are saying, hey, our First Amendment rights are being tamp down with this, and we need the ability to be able to do this. So,
Jeremy,
Jeremy,
the key to the appeals court ruling was that Governor DeWine did not include First Amendment activities in the stay-at-home order. He specifically said that First Amendment activities, whether it's going to church or doing political activities, whether it's, for instance, protesting the shutdown at the State House, was not prohibited. So neither was petition gathering, and that's what the appeals court noted in its ruling.
Right, but as Joe said, the real problem is just because they are allowed to do it now they have to do it.
Yeah.
And it's not just petition gathering, too, just being a candidate for any office here. I talked to one campaign director who said that campaigning this year is sort of like campaigning in remote Alaska, you know, where you're trying to reach people who are isolated, and you have to try things. You know, you can't go up, like Joe said, to festivals. You can't go door to door. And that's what makes, as we enter campaign season for the presidency this summer, you know, I'd be really suspicious of polls, because polls are all dependent on who comes out to vote. And it's not 100% what our election's going to look like in terms of mail-in ballots versus in-person. And so it just throws the whole thing kind of off the rails.
Yeah, let's get to that. We don't know how we're going to cast our ballots in November. As of right now, Ohio plans to use basically the same system we have been using. You know, early voting starts 30 days out from the election. The early voting is a mix of mail-in and in-person voting. Then on Tuesday, November 3rd, seems like a lifetime from now, but on Tuesday, November 3rd, the rest of voters who have not voted early will just line up and vote. Of course, that might not fit with the fears of spreading coronavirus, so groups are calling on Ohio to make the process of voting by mail easier. Joe Engels, former Secretary of State John Husted, now Lieutenant Governor, who ran elections for 8 years, says the current system is fine. May need some tweaking on deadlines, but Ohio is going forward with what it has right now, but it's going to be different.
Well, and there's a bill at the State House that would actually make some reforms that if we're going into November with similar rules that we had in April, that this bill would, for example, one thing that they had problems with the mail-in voting that we did in April was that you can apply for a ballot up until midnight on the Saturday before the election. Well, we all know how difficult it is to actually get the U.S. Post Office to deliver your ballot to you in basically a day and a half.
Yeah, that's impossible. Yeah.
Yeah. So this bill at the State House would set that date back. There's also a lot of the precincts that we have traditionally used in Ohio on Election Day are in congregate care kind of facilities in schools, in places where it might be very difficult to get in there and vote. So they're going to have to maybe go to some other places to vote, and they might be larger venues where they haven't voted before, but they need to make sure that the laws allow that. So it kind of changes where we vote and how we vote.
Yeah.
But this bill has not been addressed by lawmakers, and they're getting ready to, they're getting ready to leave, and they won't be here to address these things. So going into November, there might be a lot of questions up in the air, and we might have some of the similar problems we saw in April.
Yeah, we only have five. We have 5 months, plenty of time, right, Jeremy, to totally reorganize an election. At the very least, they have to help local boards of election get ready for what will be an increase in mail-in voting, regardless of any changes.
Well, if it's like the first 5 months of 2020, it's going to feel like about 15 years.
I know.
Right.
Well, we thought we were sort of getting back to a relative routine, and then all hell broke loose this weekend. Thanks to Joe Ingles, State House reporter from Ohio Public Radio, and to Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter at Cleveland.com. Thanks for helping us make sense of all of this to the best we can. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Mike Thompson.